This is an interview with Governor Victor Atiyah at his office in downtown Portland, Oregon. The interviewer for the Oregon Historical Society is Clark Hansen. The date is January 19th, 1993, and this is tape 14, side one. For the last few minutes, we've been talking about your interest and collection in the Lewis and Clark Expo. Mm-hmm. I've read about your interest on that. And what all does your collection consist of?
It's hard to describe, really. It's a lot of things. I think what I've just mentioned to you, I have spoons, 9 of them, all different. That kind of crossed my mind, how many souvenir spoons do you need at a fair? But there are keychains, watch fobs, a pocket watch, purses of a variety of kinds, silk handkerchiefs that we had. The government building was there in the middle of Giles Lake, and they had the mint, and so they printed on a really very fine engraving, like a bill would be a currency. Lewis and Clark, and I've got several of those. you know, it goes on and on. I just have to think, letter openers, pictures, postcards.
You said about 400 items?
I have 400 or 500 items, different. I haven't even begun to enumerate all of them. They're just an enormous amount.
Were any of these items passed down through the family?
No. Well, the only thing we have, and of course Tia Brothers has it, is the gold medal that was given to us. And again, it's a gold. They weren't gold. They were bronze. Mm-hmm. I have some, incidentally, not the Tia Brothers, but I've collected them. And I think somebody has gold-plated them. But the gold medals were bronze. When we have a banner, which is quite unusual. I've not seen that anywhere, but it says the Tia Brothers, and there's a ribbon, and it was Lewis. We have the banner, and it's all at the store. But we really didn't have much. I mean, that sort of thing, and the certificate itself. So I collected everything else. Plates, glasses, cups, saucers. Incidentally, the cup and saucer is pretty scarce. Plates, there's a lot of those. But to get a cup and saucer, which would be the official, it's sort of a blue and white. I don't know how to describe these things, but it's a blue and white, and it's Lewis and Clark Fair. There's all kinds of stamps. There were not postage stamps. These were sort of commemorative type things you're supposed to advertise, and I've got those in full blocks, complete blocks. And I'm sure other things will come to mind. A real interesting thing in that regard, when we were moving from where the Governor Hotel is now, we would have been there 28 years, I think, or longer. That's really where my brothers and I really started. Anyway, when we were moving, I don't know if we've talked about that earlier. My niece was going through some papers and stuff, and I said, you run across anything that looks interesting, let me know. So she comes up with these negatives, look like mice had chewed them sometime in the past, the edges, and I'm looking through there. She brings me these old, what we call celluloid negatives, whatever the term is, and so I'm kind of looking through them, and there's a whole bunch of countrymen, and I have no idea who they are. Mm-hmm. And all of a sudden, I said, hey, that looks like the Lewis and Clark Fair. And it turns out, actual photographs of my father and my uncle at the Lewis and Clark Fair.
Oh, that's wonderful.
It is. It's wonderful. Grand. But they're just so many souvenirs. It was just incredible. There's one. There was a different days. It was a New York day and an Illinois day, and there was Portland day, but Portland day was pretty late. And there's a little round card, I'll call it, but it's round, and a little tiny pencil with a string, and I guess you tuck it in your buttonhole. Incidentally, there was none of this short pants and sports shirt thing. Everybody was dressed up. they go in a suit to the fair, not like you and I go to a fair anymore. Anyway, this was Portland Day. Slogan was, Portland great, Portland's fine, 500,000 in 1909. Well, I don't know when they had 500,000, but it was 1909. And anyway, one of the things I did have, which the society has, I've already given them that, is really a very attractive and very good condition. I'm going to call it a circus size poster. You know, it's good size. And one of the big attractions was they call On the Trail. Now, the trail was the entertainment section. It was almost, I'm going to say bridge, maybe causeway is a better word, but it was on that causeway that would lead out to the government building. And they had all kinds of entertainment kind of things. That was the trail. Matter of fact, there was a slogan, meet me on the trail, or meet me at the trail, something of that kind. And anyway, this was a big poster that was advertising the trail. And the society has that. I don't know if we can really get together. I'd like to, you know, give them what I have, but I need a little cooperation and help from them. And rather than, as one instance, when I walked and they said, now here's what we have in this room, I need a little bit more than that.
Yeah. It wasn't itemized or?
Certainly they've got a list somewhere, but I've got a list of everything that I have. I took an inventory of it, which is a very tedious thing to do. But I did it anyway. But I'm thinking, well, I'm going to sell this. And there's one collector is interested in buying. But I haven't done anything. I keep saying, well, I really ought to see what the society would like to have. And so it's just sort of dragged on, and nothing much has happened. Coincidentally, this is interesting. I'm not sure that society would like to hear this on the tape anyway, part of my history. But I had acquired two very interesting documents. One was let me call it stock. I'm not quite sure what it was. A relatively small piece of paper. I'm trying to remember the date of it. But anyway, it was for the Portland and Valley Plank Road. Now, the Portland and Valley Plank Road is Canyon Road. And this was opening up the Tualatin Valley. And it was a pretty important thing. And somebody had subscribed, I don't know, $10 or $20. And that wasn't in particularly good shape, but I don't know where there's another one of those things. And I gave that to society. But at the same time, I had what I already knew was a very noted imprint from Oregon, 1847. And a professor at University of Oregon named Belknap, he'd written a book he called Oregon Imprints. And he did it chronologically. And this one that I'm speaking about now is number 7 in his chronological order. And it's noted to the world. And we talk about campaigning and scurrilous campaigning. I mean, this was really something. Really. And J.W. Nesmith, who turned out to be our second U.S. Senator from Oregon, but not at that time, posted this to the world on Election Day against J. Quinn Thornton, who was running for territorial judge or something like that. He called him infamous, scoundrel, liar, all kinds of terrible things in this broadside that was apparently nailed up all over the place. And it's pretty well known because it really is kind of unique. I acquired it, and I went up and talked to somebody, fortunately, for the tape, I don't remember who. And I said, gee, look at this. Now, I have some pretty good feel of what this is. The reaction was, oh, that's nice. That's nice. Belknap looked at it, and there have been some reproductions of it. And there are actually 4 known copies. Four. One at Yale, one at the University of Oregon, one MacArthur, I think probably Lewis MacArthur. Anyway, he's a descendant of Nesmith.
Oh.
And mine. and that's nice. It's really strained reaction. I would tell you, ultimately, I have given that to the society. And coincidentally, as a gun collector, after some time and some worry, I acquired a Colt Navy pistol as percussion cap and ball. But it's engraved on the back of the grip, Honorable J.W. Nesmith. And I'm positive that Colt gave that to Nesmith. Colt had a propensity for doing that sort of thing. And Nesmith was on the military committee during the Civil War. But I don't have any province. I have nothing written. It's just my own intuition and being a gun collector. And I had that for a while, and finally said, I really ought not take any chances on. So the society has that too. Anyway, this is interesting.
Well, who is the person that has the larger collection than yours?
His name is Kramer.
Kramer.
Mike Kramer.
Is that a C or a K?
It's a C, I'm sure. I've talked to him on the phone. He keeps calling me, and I say, well, Mike, it hasn't gone anywhere. He doesn't really know what I'm doing. I have, incidentally, you know, I talked about spoons.
Mm-hmm.
And spoons are known, and collectors have spoons. But I have a fork. Now, it matches, there are certain things called official. Official spoon, official cup, official plate, official, I'm going to call it coin, but it's, it would be a coin shape anyway. So there's an official spoon. But I have an official fork. And I hadn't heard about it, didn't even think about it. And I probably have the only official fork around. I don't know, somebody must have another, there's got to be a fork somewhere. Anyway, I have the official fork.
They didn't have an official dinner setting, or?
Somebody said there's a knife, and I don't know. I didn't know there was a fork, so how do I know there's a knife? Actually, I got the fork from a person, a lady that I knew. She was collecting spoons. Mm-hmm. And in the process of collecting spoons, she said she's got that in San Francisco. The antique dealer said, you really ought to have one of these. This is from Oregon, which is, of course, the fork. So I traded a spoon for a fork. So that's how I got my fork, because she was collecting spoons, not forks.
What have you heard of that idea that was being put forth by Bill Nato and other people of having another centennial of the Lewis and Clark Expo, perhaps on
2005
on the island, Ross Island? At least I'd heard that some time ago. I don't know whether he's still pursuing that.
Ross Island is pretty well dug out in the middle.
Yeah.
I don't know how much dry land there is there anymore. Regardless of where it's put, I think it would be a very good idea. Mm-hmm. Whether or not we can garner enough enthusiasm to do it right, mm-hmm, is hard to say. I know that we celebrated the centennial of Oregon. Actually, that was my first session in 1959. Which was a 100-year anniversary of the state of Oregon, and we had an exposition, but it was real Mickey Mouse. It really was not a it was not a first-rate deal. So if we can do it first-rate, first class, I think it's a wonderful idea. Mm-hmm. I really do. Mm-hmm. And certainly they can reach back and reproduce some of these old 1905 souvenir artifacts and sell them as obviously duplications, but. They say what Portland's great, Portland's fine. 500,000 in 2009.
Yeah,
I don't know.
Anyway. They'll catch up to it eventually.
But I think it's a good idea.
Uh-huh. Is there enough enthusiasm now to launch something like that, or
no? I think everybody's attention is turned in many other different directions, and whether we can get them to focus or not, I'm not sure. The Lewis and Clark Fair was very important to us economically, because it did identify there was such a place as Portland, Oregon, to the rest of the nation. And when it attracted tourists, and it did, a lot of them, they would go back home and tell about how nice it is and how good it is. It really is really sort of the springboard for Portland to grow. I don't know if the society put out paperback kind of thing. It's not paperback size, a little larger than that. Very well done. But it was a very significant affair, at least in my opinion. Among the major things that happened to identify Portland, to identify the state of Oregon, and then to a lesser degree the Northwest, and it was a big deal. It wasn't just something local consumption sort of thing.
There was a large population increase after that, wasn't there?
Yes, and we began to grow economically and businesses, and it really was, as I use the word springboard, probably a correct word in terms of our economic growth.
What were the other significant events in Oregon's development that you referred to?
Well, the major significance, of course, was the Oregon Trail and the great mm-hmm. migrations of the years, I'm trying to remember, 42, 43, 44, 45, 46, mm-hmm. throughout that period of time. It was interesting to me. I just read Joel Palmer's journal, which is republished by the Oregon Trail Coordinating Council. So I bought it, just finished reading it. And the thing that was interesting to me that there were a lot of people trying to attract those on the Oregon Trail to go to California so that California would grow and be populated. And Joel Palmer, among many, many others, you know, they weren't influenced and they kept going on into Oregon. Which reminded me of a joke that I very judiciously use of the people coming out on the Oregon Trail, and at one point there was a break, indeed there was. You know, mm-hmm. you'd go to California, you'd go to Oregon. And so one trail led south and west to California, and the other one had a sign on it that says, to Oregon. And those that could read came to Oregon. But as I say, I'm very judicious how I use that. It was an interesting journal. I read some others. I read Nesmith's diary, I guess you'd call it. I found that very interesting. I relate it to today, the strength of the people of today. Mm. Reading Nesmith, and he'd been gone, I can't remember. Joel Palmer was about 6.5 months coming here. I think maybe the journey might have been as short as it got later on, you know, as short as maybe 4 months, but still was a long journey. Mm-hmm. Tedious, tiresome, hard work. Nesmith had gone through the same thing. That's why I was reading it. And so now we're getting to the end of his journey. So one day he's at the mouth of the Columbia and the Willamette, the confluence of the two. And he's relating this all in his journal after, I don't know, 4.5, 5 months of all this hardship. Reaches the mouth of the Columbia Willamette. The next day he's at Oregon City. And the next day he goes to work. And I'm thinking to myself, you know, if I walked from here to the Lloyd Center, I'd probably want to take a week off and rest. Exaggerating, of course, but I mean, you think in terms of mm-hmm. of the reaction. And, you know, self-reliant, you know, if anything's going to happen, I've got to do it. Mm-hmm. Nobody's out here going to help me do it. Maybe my friends will assist me somewhere, but we're getting beyond that. We're getting into some philosophy of self-reliance and self-esteem and pride and all the rest of that sort of thing, mm-hmm. much of which too many people lost.
Well, I hope we can talk more about that as we get into some of your own personal philosophies on government and other matters, that's all very interesting. And it's an interesting era, and you've got quite a connection to it.
Well, it's fascinating to me. You know, my father comes from Syria, mm-hmm. got here in 1900. Then so depends on how you count, first generation born or second generation. I don't know how you count those things, but. Nonetheless, I wasn't on the trail. I can't claim any relatives that crossed over in covered wagons. I may have told you earlier that I lamented that I didn't have a grandpa that left me a gold watch, which I always thought was really kind of nice. And some of my friends, their grandpas had these big gold watches, and I thought, oh, wouldn't that be neat to have one of those things? And, And I've always been interested in history. I think it's important. I really do.
I bet even your father's trip out here was not an easy journey.
I don't think so, but it was probably rail. Mm-hmm. But we never talked about that.
And he didn't say how long it took?
Nope, I have no idea. I told you the story of how they got here, mm-hmm. but that's, I told you pretty much the way I got it.
Right.
Not that he got on the train or that Aziz, which is my uncle, came first. Or I didn't get any details. All I got was this broad brush of how they got here.
Mm-hmm.
And at that time, that was satisfactory to me. Today, it would not have been, but that's too late for that. Oh, incidentally.
Well, going back a shorter period in history, to where we left off the last time, we were talking about the 1971 legislative session. And we had talked after the discussion on the 71 session a little bit about the legislature in general and how you related to the media, your secretary, work that was conducted off the floor. And then we were talking about setbacks, controversies, disappointments that you had while you were in the legislature. Was there anything on that you wanted to add?
No, in general terms, because I don't recall when we passed the single member. Well, let's see, 59, maybe 71 would have been the first session of single member districts. But over the period of time, first of all, when I again, this may be a repeat, but I can't remember, when I first went down, we were paid $600 a year and one trip back and forth, mm-hmm. at 10 cents a mile. That would be for the 2-year period, one trip. So that amounted to, in my case, $609 one year, because I had 45 miles back and forth, or each way, 90 miles, and $600 another year. Our secretaries would sit on the floor, and they would spend an enormous amount of time amending bills. In those days, amending, you'd get an amendment sheet. Mm-hmm. And so you'd take the original printed bill, and then she would use scissors and scotch tape and would mark where the changes and cross things out. And so it was all kind of a patchwork kind of a thing. Today that doesn't happen. Today there's an amendment, goes back to the printer and they reprint the bill. It is much more efficient, but there is a disadvantage because you can't see what the change were. Obviously you can't remember. You can't really see what the changes were, where you could, obviously, when you have an amended bill. There was, the office was our desk. We had a filing cabinet along the side aisle. There was a typing room where there was just a whole lot of typewriters along the edge of the room.
Mm-hmm.
I can recall my secretary wanted to leave before the session ends, so she can go get, quote, her typewriter. Apparently there was one that she liked better than the others. And that was the whole situation. The legislators were pretty accessible. They didn't have anywhere to go unless they were in a committee, mm-hmm. or out of the building. They were at their desk. So people could easily reach them. Certainly lobbyists could. But, you know, there they were.
Mm-hmm.
So there was a great deal of accessibility. Now, okay, let's go back to it. $600 a year, accessibility on the floor, elected not in single member districts. I ran countywide in Washington County. And then gradual changes took place. We eventually built the wings, so now legislators have offices, so they can hide, and they can get away. Bills are being reprinted. Secretaries have their own typewriter. Salaries have gone up. actually gone up to the extent where, well, it obviously depends on how many committee meetings you attend and how long the session lasts, but, you know, in the vicinity of 16, 17, 18,000 a year. And as I mentioned, the single member districts. Now I keep hearing about, you know, that we need annual sessions because things are getting more complicated and more complex. It's all a lot of nonsense. All a lot of nonsense. First of all, the raised salaries, it becomes really someone's full-time job. And matter of fact, there are quite a few who that's the only job they have. And you get a lot of people that really don't have any background of experience to make decisions, or having to make decisions. Mm-hmm. So they're reluctant to. They're not quite sure how to. You know, the lengthening of sessions comes about because there just isn't any. Well, two things. One of which is they don't know how to make a decision, and secondly, one of their problems is, which way do I vote so I get reelected? Because that's my job. And legislators, as I say, are less accessible than they were before. Mm-hmm. And single-member district probably was the worst thing that we did. Well, it has to rank along with higher wages. Because provincialism really exudes all over the place. Where, and again, I may have mentioned this before, where I represented Washington County, I was from the urban to the rural. My replacement, when I resigned, having been elected as governor, my replacement was representing a much smaller district and didn't have this experience of all of Washington County. So they're voting just for that provincial interest. And really, that also adds to the length and difficulty of a session. They don't have the broad perspectives we've had. So in a general way, I've kind of gone beyond 71, but all of these things happened over a period of time, and none of them, I think, were good. And then I read, you know, we ought to pay people more, we'll get better people. That's nonsense. That's absolutely total nonsense. Because the kind of people you really want, which you call really good people, and I don't mean that these are bad people, I mean people that are competent, experienced, have made decisions, have the courage to make decisions, mm-hmm. all that sort of thing. That's what I mean. You know, they're pretty high-paying people. I don't think you can pay them enough to get that kind of person, because you'd have to start paying legislators, I don't know, in the range of 70, 80,000, 100, I don't know, a lot of money to get what they say better people, because we're not getting better people at $17,000 or $18,000. And when we were getting $600, there's a lot of people I know of were there genuinely making a contribution. They could make a lot of money. Mm-hmm. I think of Tony Uturi in Ontario. Bright, good, head screwed on well, which is the way I describe it. Clearly, as a lawyer, he can make a lot more money than $600 for, oh, then it was about 4.5 months' work. So he was making a contribution.
At the same time, a lot of people did go to the legislature to be able to get a wider reputation, and then would go back into their
businesses. Well, you find lawyers wanting to do that. Mm-hmm. They can't advertise, so that was a good way to do it. Mm-hmm. And I suppose some were there, they can make some contacts. But by and large, even then, that was quite a contribution at $600. Motel rooms gonna eat up all that.
Right.
And plus the food and all the rest of it. Anyway, they're without getting into a long discussion of dissertation, I think things have happened that didn't improve the process, actually made the process worse.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Are any of those situations reversible? Or is that
well,
too
I
difficult?
Well, I say that the quickest way to improve the quality of the legislature is to cut salaries. Hmm. Well, you know and I know that's never going to happen. But if you reduce the salaries to $600 a year, no one can live on $600 a year. So, no, certainly they're not running for their job like they are today. So there, you know, there's always these answers, which are answers.